Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 4, Episode 5, The Birthplace of Civilization. Aaron, we're halfway through the season at this point, I think. Are there 11 episodes?
Yeah. I think there might be 11 episodes.
Okay. When you're halfway through next week's episode, we'll be halfway through the season.
We're an irrational number of the way through this episode.
I've never been good at math. What'd you think of this episode?
I thought this is a great episode of Fargo. For mid-season, this is about the highest stakes you can possibly imagine the show having. And I've got to really, the death of Dr. Senator, who is a character who has delighted and informed me throughout the season. Like, I was so bummed out and angry. And got like a genuine reaction, because I thought they're going to play. It's like, well, these guys are crazy, but they're not this fucking crazy. Nope. They're this type. They're this type of self-destructive, crazy character.
Yeah.
And where it got Loy's canon character, which I thought just as profoundly arresting as well. It's got me feeling as when it's like, God damn you bastard. Why did you do this to the show? But also, boy, This was a big chip to cash in narratively. What are the stakes going to be 3 episodes from now? I'm like excited. I'm invested. I thought it was incredible. What'd you think?
I did too. I have some slight problems with the episode, and they're mostly centered around what I think is everyone's least favorite character, Gaetano.
I'm not going to try to defend that too much.
I'm not either, but man, the rest of the episode is so good.
It is.
It's not just the death of Dr. Senator, which is monumental. It's also that scene with Rabbi and Josto talking about, you know, his expected plans, Gaetano's expected plans. Like, he's going to bring guys in and you're going to have to divide them, otherwise they multiply. It's that so coded good. Gangster language, and it's catch. Like, that whole scene is brilliantly written. The dialogue just pops, and it runs the risk of border of rolling over into like too writerly at times. But man, it walks that line, and it's super clever, and I really appreciated it. The Dr. Senator stuff, that is also amazingly written. Like, it's a really long scene, right? It starts. Mm-hmm. I guess it starts when he walks in to the coffee shop, and it's probably a 10-minute scene.
Could be, yeah.
Between that and when we finally cuts black at the end of the episode, he's one of my favorite characters. He's probably my favorite character. He's certainly the smartest character in the show, and he's one of the most valuable pieces that's just been wiped off the board. And you got to wonder how Loy's going to react to that. Like, if he reacts so harshly to his son being hit by the cops and arrested, what's he going to do when they're killing his consigliere?
I mean, yeah, this is no longer pretend war. This is no longer you know, proxy stuff. This is it's bad. It's bad, and I think it's going to lead to Loy calling his banners in. There's a question about will the Fargo Mafia respond, you know? Are they going to actually ride to the rescue? It's a numbers game. You got Cannon versus the Fadas. But on the other hand, the Fadas are divided against themselves.
Yeah.
With maybe reinforcements to both sides on the way. So it's a really complicated political situation here. And I love that scene from with Josto and Rabbi Mulligan reminded me so much of some of the smarter inner gangster sanctorum scenes from like Miller's Crossing. I'm on a real gangster kick, and I feel like we're gonna be doing Casino. We just got done doing Goodfellas. What was another one we just did recently? I feel like we ought to do Miller's Crossing sometime early next year, just to cap it off, because it's a unique take on the lore. But yeah. I thought this episode was great. And again, yes, everyone saying that we got Nacho Libre in the middle of this gothic gangster opera. You're not wrong. You're not wrong. I don't know why it's happening. I can't explain it. It doesn't seem like it's working for anyone. But, you know, sometimes I try to grade that type of stuff on a curve, because this is just, every once in a while, like, my favorite gangster movies will do this. They'll go with, like, God, what was the season Bobby Cannavale showed up at on Boardwalk Empire, and he's a fucking maniac, and I'm like, what is this bull in the China, this intellectual gangster China shop? Like, this isn't going to work. This never fucking works. But I, you know, occasionally it happens. Sometimes you get some dumb fuck cousin brother situation and you can't do nothing about it, apparently. I don't know. I think we'll talk about it.
Yeah, for sure. We will.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Where do you want to start with this episode?
Well, I've been dividing, you know, this is a very just business type of season. I've been dividing all the plot into everybody's individual businesses. And I've kind of got like a blend of structural and chronology going. I like to start with Ethel Rita's business.
Okay.
In this episode, because that's how we start. And she sets up a lot of the narratives that kind of run through everybody else's business. We have this beginning scene that reminds me a lot of last week, to the extent that, like, I'm not even sure if we're not having a bit of a flashback in the same way that, like, episode 2 flashback to kind of episode 1. You know, it's like you had Timothy Oliphant kicking in the door and then you had to back up to get... She was writing a letter late at night when the ghost visited her. She's writing a letter again. Is she just writing letters all the time, or do you twig on to what I'm talking about here?
She might be writing letters all the time. I don't know. It's the 50s. I have to keep thinking, like, both both shows I'm watching currently are taking place in the 50s, which is weird.
And she's a smart girl, and I figure that smart girls would be sending more than the average amount of letters to people.
Yeah, like, yeah. She and she's not just a smart girl, right? She's Ethel Rita Pearl Smutney, so...
She's one of a fucking kind, and she might be writing senators, doctor senators, congresspeople.
Sure.
Mayors. Who knows? Who knows? But she's, in this case, she's... There's simultaneous action of her writing this letter to inform Dr. Harvard of Nurse Mayflower's, Angel of Death routine... While Nurse Mayflower is watching a man whose guts seem to be trying to come out of his asshole.
Sure. That's accurate.
And she's, what is she doing here? Has she poisoned him and she's misjudged a dose that's taking longer for him to die than he should? She's bashing her head against the wall. What's happening here, Jim?
I don't know. I feel like this shouldn't have really even been in this episode. Like, if this is all you're going to do with Mayflower this episode, save it for the next episode where you can do more. My read on this is that she is trying to fly a little bit straight, at least in the early goings of working at this hospital, and that she is bored out of her mind and not being able to kill this guy who's moaning and driving her crazy.
He's in obvious pain. Why, you know, it'd be better for everyone if he would just die, right?
Right, and maybe she can't do it because no one's asked her to, right? Maybe it's like some, you know, vampire can't come into your house sort of thing. I don't know.
Which is also kind of name-checked in this episode. That's interesting because, like, now I'm thinking this scene's an even bigger failure because I didn't get that. I mean, that's useful information to convey to the audience that Nurse Mayflower is having a hard time. She's, like, really white-knuckling, not killing people because she's at this new job. And juxtaposing that with Ethel Rita writing a letter might be something where Dr. Harvard gets this letter and is like, well, this is ridiculous. She's not killing people. But it might put her. Yeah, I interpret it as, you know, he's, oh, my God, my guts, I'm dying. She's poisoned him. Right.
It could be. Yeah. Like I said, that's just my interpretation of it. I find it interesting that Ethel Rita is lying about who she is. Saying I've worked alongside Miss Mayflower for years and years. So,
did she say worked or lived?
I thought she said worked. I thought she was like lived. Making it her colleague, but you might be right.
But you might be right too, because I was in one of those things where it's like, I guess I was hearing what I was wanting to hear, or just translating, knowing like, oh, I guess she's lived there for a few years. Maybe she has too, and. She's well known around the funeral parlor. Like her father said that's that's one of her character traits. She always visits the people that she loses under her watch, which ominous. But yeah, so her dad busts in and says, hey, it's your birthday tomorrow. She asks him about laudanum, which I thought he did as a dad. He did a remarkable good job of like probably freaking on the inside. Why is my daughter asking about laudanum? But like not letting, like just being like, OK, sure, here's the information. And she volunteers that she saw it at the nurses and that kind of relaxes him. But he also mentions, hey, you know, we're kind of outlaws now. Maybe we shouldn't hang around shady racist folks that might want to cause problems for us. Mm-hmm.
It's hilarious the way he describes it. I don't think this guy has ever completed a sentence in his life. He always trails that last word off and just kind of shrugs and moves his head a little.
I've known guys like that, yeah, where it's like, are they even here in the plane of reality at all?
Asks if she's going to see her aunt again, he says she's just an escaped convict, you know? Like, this is totally kind of normal, right?
Just how matter of fact he is about everything. Like, you know, and honestly, it's, I think she might have poisoned us with that pie. So, you know, keep your head on a swivel.
That's a weird reaction to being poisoned.
I feel like he's like, if you're a white dude running a funeral parlor, married to a white lady or a black lady, sharing and raising a black daughter in the Midwest in the 1950s, you probably have a layer of circumspection about every interaction you have, because else you would just go insane. You go insane with the reality of like half the people in town want you dead. The other half of the half probably want to run you out. And then 25% of people, if they really think about it, like, oh, okay, I guess it's all right. Like it's gotta be some kind of defensive reaction. But or maybe only a person that obtuse could survive the situation too. It's like right. a selection thing rather than a defensive thing. Mm-hmm. Either way, Ethelreda decides she's going to go visit her auntie mm-hmm. and her best friend, and they show up at the New Paris and explain the difference between squares and convicts and outlaws, which I thought it was a really good conversation, especially as it pairs well with Deffy kind of like reframing all that in a very harsh light towards the end of the episode. But yeah, and just like the absolute swagger that she brings to this rule or this role where, you know, are you an outlaw? Are you a square? Are you this? And she's like, I'm Ethel Pearl Smutney. I'm Ethelreda Pearl Smutney. I'm one of a kind. Yeah. Like,
she doesn't play by anybody's rules but her own, not even the outlaws.
She doesn't, but it's like one of those things where like this singular and irrepressible of spirit, it seems doomed to be snuffed out or beat down. And you start to see, like, you know, in the first episode, like the principal's got it in for her, always wanting to take her down that peg. You know, Deffy beats her up pretty good in this episode. Her parents are going to be neutered by the cannons. I'm curious to see if Ethel this version of Ethelreda survives this season. Mm-hmm. Like physically, sure, but like spiritually, what survives? And things kind of look grim after this episode, honestly.
Yeah, we'll see. One of the things I like about that scene that's just funny to me is when they talk about her birthday and they say, you know, they're gonna have a cake and whatnot. Even after her experience last episode, Swanee is jumping at the prospect to have some cake from that house, right?
She's got a sweet tooth and a savory victuals tooth, and they're long and sharp, man.
Jeez. Just cool it on the desserts for a second.
Yeah, there's also stuff going on in the background with the plot where, you know, it's... These characters keep getting shifted and looked at like Rubik's cubes or kaleidoscopes because, you know, we'll later hear the heinous crimes these women are accused of. But also, like, there's this line where she says, are you saying you're innocent of the crime? She's like, innocent? I've been innocent since your uncle cornered me in the broom closet when I was 10 or 11 or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, we heard about from a Swanee, you know, what the school teachers tried to do to her. It's just showing that like none so much of this American mythos about, you know, life about, you know, if you go to school and you work hard and you do this and you do that, everything will work out fine. Like it just belies that like there are astonishingly few personal choices that we get to make, like truly just like, oh, you know, in a vacuum, here's what I'll do. Mm-hmm. Everything affects everything. And you know, I thought it's great the way that this is showing that like people kind of get trapped into the lives that they lead and they don't really have any other off ramps onto it, you know, like yeah. telling these women to just like, hey, stop committing crimes. Like, what does that mean? Like they decided to go off the reservation literally and metaphorically, you know, when they were 13 years old. What are you going to tell them?
Yeah.
This kind of transitions to canon business. We're going to hook up with Ethelreda later in some U.S. official martial business. But right now, the other thing that kind of opened the episode was this. I really thought this was a fun. These scenes where they're in this jazzy swinging nightclub and everybody's having a good time. And the music's hot and the conversation is. People are dancing. And then the fuzz comes and the party is fucking over. Mm-hmm.
As it always is. You can't have cops bust in a party and still keep the party going.
It's never good, unless it's the Fraternal Order of Police and there's state-sanctioned hookers and blow there. Uh-huh. All other parties get kiboshed. You know, they had a ripped out of the headlines, cop trying to choke a black man to death situation.
Which headline are you talking about?
That's perennial. Like, yeah, those stories bloom eternal, apparently.
Yeah.
And will until we decide collectively it's enough. Mm-hmm. But then you know, Leon and his son both get cracked in the skull and carted off to jail, and we see the Fadas across the street, you know, looking at all the chaos, and Josto is very satisfied and Gaetano is very skeptical. We'd have a scene with Loy showing off the goods, the Mort Kellerman from the Fargo Mafia Syndicate outfit, trading guns for loyalty. What do you think about Mort Kellerman's loyalty here? Is he going to go to war with the Itais, as they say?
Oh, boy. I hate to say it, but look, we're talking about the 1950s here. I think if Loy Cannon wasn't black and his whole crew wasn't black, I'd have more faith in that, in this alliance that they're trying to fledge here. But I'm not so sure that they can count on their loyalty.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted that. That's and the fact that the Cannons gave him the lion's share of the guns. I also didn't understand, you know, 150, 150, 200, 100 in your favor, but you give him the lion. Maybe he's got tons of guns. He's got enough guns. He's got
and the guys to muscle. Use them. You know, right. 200 guns does you no good if you have 50 guys.
Right, but if Mort Kellerman has 200 dudes and 200 guns, you see what I'm saying? Like, he might just be like, you know what? Fuck the Italians and fuck the Cannons too. I'm taking over the whole town.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see. But I just thought it's like, oof. I'm not sure. I think it's a good play. It's a good play. But what are the assurances too? You know, like when you call your debt and they're like, actually, you know, we're busy up in Fargo. Can you do more than just shake your fist? Like, there's a lot of calculus going into criminal math, you know?
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, like, okay, well, I'm promising, but how are they going to enforce the promise? Because if I can just welch on that, then...
Welching on my promise means that they're not going to be around to then take retribution for that...
Right.
What does it matter, you know?
And my other rival left will be significantly weakened. And even if you prevail, you'll be weak enough that I can finish you off. Like, it's...
It's the castle risk dilemma.
It is. The first person that draws blood is taking the biggest risk.
Sure.
Something Alan Sepinwall pointed out in his review that I didn't pick up on my first watch or any of my watches is... When the outfit from Fargo rolls up to pick up the guns, they're in this truck with Treehorn Trucking labeled. Did you get this reference?
I saw that. Yeah, that's a Big Lebowski reference.
Yeah, the porn reference to porn magnate Jackie Treehorn.
Hell yeah,
from the Big Lebowski. So, yeah, I just thought that was a nice little Coen Brothers reference.
Mm-hmm.
Inside, and so this is interesting. Loy says the funeral parlor's ours now. We own this thing. And he's directing his gang to say, you know, to tell them that, hey, you need to go over there and take show them that we mean business. The cops bust in and change up the whole plan. He ended up like this is so serious that he decided to take matters in his own hand. His gang is all arrested, but he shows up personally to take possession. I thought that was an interesting character note of his.
Mm-hmm.
That like. Another person would have chosen to maybe just conclude this business another day when you're back to full strength. But Cannon, what did you pick up on that too? Like just how
I didn't. But
is that a positive? Is that a strength or a weakness?
That's a good question. It's certainly in line with what he says about I'm willing to do whatever it takes to win. You know, regardless.
But it makes him such a target. I guess he's carting around Zero. But, like, I don't think Gaetano gives a fuck about shooting Zero.
No.
If he cared, he wouldn't have targeted Loy's son. It's just, it's one of those things where it's, like, really hard to tell, like, what's smart and what's not because it's, you know, what can you get away with, I guess.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, this episode is all about telling you that there are no rules, right? Like, that scene where Loy is sitting at the table with DeBrill and Thurman, and Thurman's, like, talking about, well, I've never done this before. Like, this is my first time getting in bed with gangsters. What are the rules? Well, there are no rules, man. The rules are whatever you can make the rules.
Go and look at the U.S. law. Go and look at the U.S. law code for rules. Oh, no, you just drove off the map, dude.
Yeah.
There's no...
You're in uncharted territory, man. The only thing you have is your wits and your brains. So figure it out.
Boy,
and
he's
so unequipped
Thurman.
For that.
You're gonna be leaning awful hard on DeBrill for both of those things, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
But we get a big dump about Otis's backstory here, Weff's backstory, Detective Weff. His role, because, you know, this doesn't explain the OCD. The OCD is just something you're more or less born with, but it explains why it's wildly out of control. Because he was a minesweeper selected precisely because he had this kind of rigid way of thinking and this systematic way of doing things that would allow him to do a pattern and never deviate to where another soldier might get distracted by boredom or fatigue or tedium. He just was remained locked in. But as Chris Rock explains, something went wrong with the colonel and him lying down in the field and looking at clouds. And there's a dispute about this. We'll catch back up to this in a minute. I thought it was a great scene, but importantly, it was a really excellent use of Chris Rock. I think that the show continues to really dial in what about Chris Rock can be menacing. Because in this one, he's channeling that kind of like, you know, every once in a while he shifts into this like really cruel bully gear, like on stage when he's really got a bit between his teeth and he's really worrying it or he's really laying into somebody or dealing with a heckler. Yeah. And I felt like he brought that energy to this scene, and he didn't give a fuck whether he triggers this guy and he gets shot. Or he's just not going to have it. So
yeah, it's a good scene, and Jack Houston is excellent in this episode, not just in this scene but later as well. Chris Rock is really growing on me, and this scene has a couple of barn burners for him, or this episode rather has a couple of barn burner scenes. Like that scene with his family and his wife and his mother-in-law. Yeah, it's really good. He's grown on me.
In fact, I just want to roll from that right in, because the next scene in the canon line of business is his putting down of a domestic insurrection with his wife and his mother-in-law. You know, the chickens have come home to roost. He's made these moves. He's put their sons at risk continually and in an escalating manner, and she as a mother has fucking had enough. And then Loy kind of puts them both back on their heels. This is another, like I said, great scene where he turns this corner and engages this kind of cruel, ferocious gear. What do you think
the particulars of it aren't really anything I haven't seen before. Like, you know, calling out, oh, you're living high on the hog off of what I provide. Like, that's been in 100 different things before.
Sure.
It's a pretty efficient way, though, to allow Chris Rock to stretch. Because, like, I don't know. I mean, somewhere along the way, she did choose this, right? And I don't know. It's hard to say, like, you consciously choose this life. But you end up in this life, and there isn't really a way out. Like, what's Loy going to do even if he wanted out? I guess he could roll up shop and just.
You could absolutely go legit, but that's a process.
He's and trying, it's hard right?
to do and, in the middle of a fucking gang war.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Michael Corleone's problem. Man, all you want to do is go legit, but he could never get out of the. Fighting the battles he needed to do to get out of that. Same thing happened to Walter White.
That's what I mean. It's been done many times before, but it's effective. And Chris Rock.
Yeah, and it's a permanent loss because like you can absolutely cow your woman as a man with you know, physically intimidating. You're bigger, stronger. You know, you can physically bully them, especially if you have emotional and financial leverage over. They're dependent on you for the nice things and the food over there. You can do that, but the cost is they're never going to look at you the same when you pull this shit. And that's something that Loy's going to, I imagine, is going to be a story of like he saves his family and protects his family and destroys his family all at the same time. He's not going to have, to the extent that, like, you know, if these Mike Mulligan theories are true, his own son is going to turn his back on the family name and repudiate him, which is kind of already happening with his older son. So bleak shit. Like, this is not like an amazing, masculine scene here. This is a person who's burning the relationship he has with his wife and his family.
There are like two families here, right? There's his crime family and there's his family. And I think the show is playing with that a little bit. Like, if, you know, if the attack on his kid isn't enough to push this into total war, well, then the attack on his other family, Dr. Senator, is going to be the thing that does it, I think. which mm-hmm. we'll talk about that. But they're, you know, contrasting, or they're comparing these two quote unquote families that he has and how far he's willing to go for each of them and how he treats each of them. And I don't know. We'll see how he deals with Leon. I think that'll be important.
Yeah. Speaking of Leon, there are the whole Cannon gang minus Loy and Dr. Senator are in this holding cell. And Leon's trying to defend himself from these accusations. You can tell he's guilty because he's pacing back and forth, wearing grooves, as they say. And, you know, he's saying, like, I did everything I could. I went try to hustle him at the back door. I fought against an insurmountable number of police. And the guys came back with, like, you fucked up before you even got to that situation.
Yeah.
You were going to be fucked up because you took him there. Like, you went to this illegal thing. He's underage. There's all this hooch. There's all these prostitutes. There's drugs.
Hilarious, you know. When he says, you know, the place is full of booze and syphilis, and then they do a cutaway. I don't know the guy's name, the guy with the weird eye. They do a cutaway to him, and he just kind of like nods, like, yep, syphilis. Mm-hmm. Hilarious.
And then Leon realizing, like, oh god, I'm fucked. You know, I had one, you know, you had the one job, Leon, and you messed it up.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty good. And then you see this, the cops arranging a private meeting with Afadas, and Josto comes in here and he delivers this epic speech, which he thinks is going to single-handedly end the war. And I there's a lot of really great stuff in here. Like, you know why America loves a crime story? Because America is a crime story. Mm-hmm. And showing the difference between people like him, where people's like, oh, he's just scrapping to get ahead. Like, I do crime to get ahead. When people see you, all they see is crime. Yeah. Like, fuck, that is a hell of a line. And, you know, this whole stuff, like, he's not saying anything that's not true. Like, you're fighting everything. You're fighting the entire system. I'm just, you know, paying cops to look the other way. It was all designed to make these gentlemen give up. Now, of course,
to scare
them. Just going to do the opposite. It's going to galvanize them in action. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I thought that was a great scene. Milligan stepping up to ask whether, you know, Loy's going to settle or go to war, and then promising to keep his son safe because you people are all going to be dead anyway.
Yeah.
I didn't consider this as a possibility that Milligan would just, you know, go rabbit, take Satchel and be like, we're out of here. What do you think Satchel thinks about that?
I don't know. Has that boy said a word the entire show? Like,
not many, we
don't have any insight into what he's feeling at any time. He just stares.
And from his perspective, it must feel like his family's abandoned them. Like, he only gets to see his mom, like, what, for a couple minutes on Thanksgiving Day.
Like, I assume that's the case, but like I said, we don't know anything about him.
Yeah. And Loy's pretty gruff guy. Although he does have his, like, there's some kind of tender moments with him and Zero, which we've seen throughout the season. I don't know how to do the math on that. And it might be the right call. If all you care about is protecting this innocent child, like, I do think that it's 50-50 about who ends up on top. Like, I was trying to think of, like, it's impossible to state the situation because I don't know, like, what, you know, reinforcement Josto can expect from the official side of the family. I don't know what Gaetano can bring from the old world. I don't know what Mort's going to do up in Fargo. I don't really know how big Cannon's organization is. Like, and the fact that it's not going to be a united FATA front, right? It's going to be a divided FATA front. That's just and you got the police and the marshal situation. I honestly don't know how to score this fight. Everything being equal, I guess I'd go with Cannon because I think he's smarter at the top. But shit, that's a lot of variables, man.
Yeah, and I think it seems like the Italians just have more guys. The FATAs are better connected. Although that Casey Mafia... the Fargo Mafia seems like it could bring a lot of firepower. So maybe he's got all the guys he needs.
They're hinting with this us versus them mentality, the idea that, like, maybe Cannon, Loy's gang is not big, but, like, the neighborhoods behind it, like, how many cousins and brothers and uncles if you say, hey, it's us versus these guys and they're muscling in, they're killing us and they're trying to run us off. And, you know, you rely on us for your, you know, your card games and rely on us for your Thanksgiving turkeys at Thanksgiving. And like they start calling in favors and like suddenly they got a whole bunch more people. I don't know. It's just something they talked about in terms of like how they view the police. But I think it would be pretty easy to get people viewing it that way in terms of organized crime. If you had your team and their team. I wonder if they're going to go in that direction.
We'll see.
So, next bit of business is, the Smutneys are preparing for Ethel Rita's birthday and, Loy Cannon shows up to collect the mortuary business. And this is, it's a much less violent version of the scene from Pulp Fiction where Jules explains, you know, my name's Pitt and you're not talking your way out of it. Like, these people's lives are already over and they have to go through the five stages of grief about it. But from Nick's perspective, they're already dead people. They're just walking around because they can help him out right now. And watching them all come to grips with that, especially Thurman, I thought was really fucking, really fucking powerful.
Yeah. And they're doing some thematic stuff about the wielding of power here, between this scene and the one with, Deffy and Ethel Rita later, where she's threatened with expulsion if she doesn't give up the place, that Zelmer is hiding. And they're both like, I love the structure of this. I love how they bring together both of these, powerful forces, bearing down on Zelmer and Swanee by the end of this episode. And the orchestration, it's really tight. And I've seen it done other places, but this is good. But they're both like using similar language. Like at this scene, DeBrille, when she's, you know, realizes what's up, she says, oh, Mr. Cannon, please. She's trying to, you know, beg her way out of this, the same thing that Ethel Rita does when Deffy approaches her. And they're both being put to a choice. Give up your sister or aunt, depending on who you are, or your life is going to be ruined, right? And they both make the same choice. And I think, I'm not sure exactly what they're trying to say about these people, but they're definitely comparing the two and saying that they would rather preserve themselves than, you know, protect their sister or aunt.
Or is it like it's just showing that like, both of them might think they're kind of got a little bit of outlaw in them, or at least a little bit of that twinkle in the eye, but like when the chips are down, they're squares.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
Definitely squares. I think that's another thing they're trying to say.
Could absolutely be. And they're giving up that outlaw.
Yeah. And they're showing the connection, because they've also been talking about the connection that like Ethel Rita shares with her mom.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't see it. Right. And I don't think each other see it. But I don't know. Like but what are they doing with that? Because
yeah.
I don't know that that's satisfying, that like this independent spirited character gets relegated to a square. I don't know. Which it's like, you tell the truth to power, but a lot of times, power's still going to prevail. It's laudable to do it, but holy shit. It's not a trump card. It just works all the time.
No, and that is absolutely what they're getting at. Like the power there is what matters. Like you can beg, you can try and be the outlaw, but eventually the power, whether it's, you know, Loy Cannon with his underworld power or Deffy with his legal power,
absolutely,
is going to come down and it's going to do what it wants and it's going to bend you to its will. And that is an intimidating and scary thing. And, you know, they're defending bad people. Like, I don't think Zelmer and Swanee are very good people, but also they're being manipulated into cooperation by the power that these are wielding.
Yeah. I also thought this is another good scene for Chris Rock. And I thought this one uses a lot more of just his naked comedic energy, just put the different, cause this scene and the other scene where he was like, bullying his wife, I got a lot of the, there's this particular one of his old comic series where he's talking about how daddies don't get any respect. Like, nobody's like, hey, dad, thanks for the lights being on. I don't have to squint to see because the lights are on. And, oh, I really appreciate that food was on the table. Like, there's yeah. a lot of that kind of energy when he's talking about, like, oh, we're past, please. We're at the whatever you want, boss. Just don't kill me.
Right, right.
we're at that phase. Like, that's, like, really funny, but also he's going to kill these people. Mm-hmm. He's talking about painting the kitchen with their blood and waiting for the daughter to show up. This is Butcher from The Boys, which we talked about how effective it was a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And Chris Rock is doing it, man. Mm-hmm. So then Leon tries to explain himself to his boss, and that didn't work too well. It's funny that they just... I feel like there's a lot of tension being built up with this confrontation being so much made of it, and yet it is delayed.
Yeah.
Because like some of this, like if Loy wants to, he could put Dr. Senator's death on Leon, right? Like, hey, if you'd have played your job as babysitting my son and took it even halfway serious, you wouldn't have gotten shot up. We wouldn't be in this situation. You wouldn't have had my son pinched and I had to distract myself and have Dr. Senator run around doing all this shit, getting you boys out of like, I feel like all this anger and grief might just get poured out on poor Leon here.
You might not be wrong. Yeah, that's something I've made a.
They've made a lot, and I'm not sure because there's two ways you can do it. You can lean into that, like I'm talking about, or you could do like the Darth Vader at the end of Empire Strikes Back, where like, boy, you really think Admiral Piet's going to get it because he's let the Falcon get away. And then Vader's just kind of lost in thought and thought just walks off like, oh, I guess, you know. You did an okay job of getting the... I don't know. It could go either of those two ways where Loy could just, like, retreat into himself or look for an outlet to beat the shit out of somebody, punish somebody. But we'll see. They also are immediately going to disembark to go to pick up the hotel. We find out that the marshal is also inbound at the same time. So Loy busts in on Zelmer and... Swanee? Yeah. And they think they're there to kill him or rape him. Loy's actually there to hire him and put him to work because they owe him and he wants him to work it off. And because he explains he needs invisible soldiers for this war he's going to fight. And then he hustles him into a car just as the marshal gets upstairs and is there to overlook at it.
Yeah, crucially, he sees that happen, which cannot be good for them.
No, it's probably going to give him the wrong... Well, I mean, there's no right idea a U.S. Marshal could have about the situation.
Absolutely not, especially a racist one.
Yeah, we're using... You see, we're using these girls as assassins to kill some other good, bad dudes. Yeah. You know, well, it's fine. It's fine. It's really fine. So, yeah, that's just a non-starter. And it he's so close. The good Lord had him shake the tree... He shook mm-hmm. the tree, and he came so close to getting that ripe fruit, and it moves him to almost swear, son of a biscuit.
They definitely prominently showed the license plate. They didn't do, like, a B-roll cut to it, but it was very obvious. It was very red.
Yeah. Plus, you know, how many black gangs are there in Kansas City? It's not going to be a huge leap of police work to figure out what's going on here. So, no, I don't know.
Shake a couple more trees.
Because the law's already up the cannon's ass. Now they're going to have an outside agency agitating for it, too. This is just a bad deal for them to happen.
Yeah.
So this does bring us to one official piece of U.S. Deputy Marshal's business. I want to go through Deffy's kind of storyline since it's dovetailed to this. Crucially, all that stuff that we talked about in the beginning of the episode where Detective Weff is going around and kicking in doors and busting heads of the cannons for the Fadas, Marshal Deffy saw all that go down, you know, looking at him with spyglasses and stuff. So he visits Weff the next day, expresses hurt that he wasn't invited on the raids, and then says that he had... We get his backstory from Weff's point of view. I guess we should talk there. Weff gets to retell the story from his point of view, that the reason he laid down in the fields is not because the minesweeper gig got to him, but because his betrothed, the girl he left behind to fight the war, got raped and violently killed.
Yeah. And then
he decided to just not give a shit. Now, he vociferously disagreed with the assessment that Loy made, that he said he cleared the field and he didn't, and the colonel then got blown up taking a leak. But this story seems like he was building up to just admitting to that. What do you think? Do you think there's any daylight between these two stories, that there might be something else to the story?
I hadn't really considered it. I feel like the one that I trust the most is his firsthand retelling of the thing, as opposed to, because we don't even know who Loy heard this story from, right? Like,
sure.
That was my first question when he started going into his backstory. I'm like, who told him this? Who's he hanging out with that knows enough about that guy? Probably Dr. Senator heard it somewhere. So I don't know. I'm pretty inclined to just take him at his word here.
I just still think so do you think the colonel rolls up and asked him, did you clear this field? And because they stop. We stop with him laying in the field, looking up the sky, saying that the clouds are beautiful. I don't think he cleared that field. What's not clear to me is, like, why did the colonel go ahead and try to cross it? Was he honest with the colonel and the colonel said, too bad? Did some other guy lie on their behalf, or what?
Yeah,
I don't know.
My feeling is he's just out of it at that point, right? He hears about his wife. He has been doing this extremely stressful mind clearing job, right? It's not exactly a walk in the park.
Sure.
He's already got some, like, OCD kind of tendencies, mental issues that he's dealing with. And then that on top is just enough to break him, where he just lays down in the field. He doesn't know who he's talking to. He doesn't know what he's saying to him. Just, yeah. Oh, there's a person over there. Yes, sir. Like,
yeah. I am curious to see if there is a little bit more to the story, because I think it's interesting, because this is the way the show's way of saying is, like, you know, this is not necessarily how people with OCD behave. Like, you know, nowadays you can, through medicine and therapy and, you know, avoiding triggers and what, you can live a rich, full life. But, like, in 1950, with this much fucking stress and these many triggers and this much guilt and this just wildly untreated and exacerbated OCD, he is just this bundle of neuroses. My question here is Deffy taking a liking to Otis, or starting to feel sorry for him, or is he just working a suspect in an efficient way?
I feel like it's more of the latter. I don't get a read on him like he really has any friends. I get a read on him like he is his job.
I feel like the guy's story is tragic, like, you know, like from Deffy's perspective, hey, this guy's trying to serve his country. And he gets done dirty in the worst possible way. He's got he's got all these kind of neuroses and twitches. And, like, now I understand it. Like, I could see him trying to redeem him, you know, as his role of elder of the 77th scroll or whatever the fuck it is. I could see him, like, trying to redeem this guy or recruit him, even, frankly.
Yeah.
Which is the same thing, I guess, to an evangelical sect.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, yeah, this is also the most efficient way to work a suspect. You gain their trust, you build them up, you make them think you're friends, you form an emotional connection, and you use that mutual respect to get them to tell you the things you need. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
And I mean,
I don't know.
Jack Houston in the scene is pretty amazing. Maybe outshined by Timothy Olyphant with just a single look. Because there's that thing when he's just, like, sort of innocently asking, like, oh, if you don't mind, what did her in, you know, what'd she die of? And then he tells this horrible story, and they cut over to Timothy Olyphant, who was not expecting that answer, and he just raises his eyebrows, and it cracked me up. It's that dark humor that Fargo does so well. I love that moment. And then there are a couple of other moments with Timothy Olyphant where he's just like, man, he's so good. He's so good at what he does. And I don't know that I've ever seen him play a character this bad, which is nice.
Yeah, yeah. Like, just nakedly and evil. I think he played the villain in, like, a Die Hard, and there's a couple others where he's played anti-heroes. But yeah,
yep.
This guy is...
I always confuse him and Josh Duhamel, who is in Transformers. He's not in Die Hard, right? I can't remember which one is in which.
So. No, I don't think so. He is in Transformers. I know who you're talking about. Do you think there's going to be anything about this private ceramic collection he's got, these Alpine Shepherd's Boys that he's got in strict formation?
I don't know. The Hummels?
Is that going to be one of those represents each minesweeper that got blown up in World War II that he knew?
Yeah, could be. I took it just as like a trinket that his fiance collected. But
and he's got all rigid order. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a memory of her.
So anyway, the marshal's going to go shake the tree for the good Lord. Just go shake the suspect tree, and he continues to do so. He meets up with Ethelreda towards the end of the episode, where she gets called into the principal's office, and everyone's haranguing her about being this damn colored girl who's brought the wrath of the U.S. Marshals. Like, there's what have you been up to? What kind of terrible stuff have you been doing? And U.S. Marshal takes the tack, you think your aunt is one thing, but here is, she's the type of person who will kill a man and his pregnant wife to steal $10 from him, not even $10. And her partner will kill a respected banker and Little League coach in this inept prosecution of crime. I think this is effective, except for, in my mind, I'm screaming, well, he could just be making this shit up. You know, like,
sure.
Like, I'm not saying that, like, Zalmare and Swanee are good people, like you said, but, like, you know, are they this bad and wanton criminal? I mean, maybe they are, but, like, you know, cops can lie to you, man.
I think it would benefit the show. It would be important to let the audience know that that's what's happening if he is lying. I think you need to give us some indication that he's just applying pressure to her not telling the truth, because as of now I'm taking it at face value. He's in a position to know particular history on them, so
but then he goes, I think he's getting some work done, and then you know, he goes a little bit too far with his marks about her being civilized, and she schools him on where civilization actually came from and our mutual shared branches of the family tree. And so I think it's amazing, because they set this up as a literal carrot and stick situation. Mm-hmm. He offers her the literal carrots from his pocket. And now once his silver tongue doesn't get what he wants. And what's interesting is, like, this factual information, like, she is literally ridiculous to this man. Mm-hmm. Like, she's talking stuff that's blasphemy. He doesn't probably care that much about science and doesn't think all that much about evolution as a Christian in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And here's this person from an inferior race telling him that they're the same, and with a smirk on their face, acting like she's got some kind of leverage. And he just destroys it and is like, okay, here's the deal. You either tell me what I want now or you're getting expelled.
Yeah. I'm going to ruin one of your lives. You pick.
Jesus Christ. What a fucking dilemma. And Ethelreda folds like a cheap suit, because what else? Yeah, what is she going to do?
It's a tough decision. Do you defend the outlaw, or do you throw away your future prospects, right, that she's been working so hard on?
I feel like that's a lesson all bright kids have to learn, that, like, yeah, we all say it's good to speak truth to power, but also you got to pick your battles, because power wins 90% of the time. So you got to make sure it's worth dying or ruining your life for, because, you know, if you just lip off to everybody, you become Gaetano, I guess. I'm actually surprised that they haven't done the Deffy routine. I thought that was going to be an ongoing bit of, like, you know, she was going to try to tell him something that he wasn't trying to hear, and he's going to be part. But they've kind of abandoned that, haven't they?
Yeah, it was in that one episode, and I haven't seen it since.
Yeah, I thought he had, with his showdown between Gaetano and Calamita, I thought that would come back around. Maybe they're saving it, but they also might have just abandoned it as, like, well, that's annoying. Like,
oh, and they didn't abandon Gaetano's Jack Black routine. We'll see.
Or, like, maybe you know, Timmy the Elephant comes across more when he's just verbally brawling with people. Like, he's a smart guy. He's articulate. Let him do that. Like, let him run. Yeah. I don't know, but I thought it was weird that they didn't do it.
Sure.
Well, that'll round us into the Fada business, which has the big bombs of the evening.
Yeah.
Up front, a great little scene, as you've already said, where Rabbi Mulligan, Milligan. I'm trying to give him a mulligan. I'm going to take a mulligan on that name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come back for it. Milligan. Rabbi Milligan and Josto are talking about the art of war, essentially, and mathematics and the English language. You just saw a brief skirmish with me seconds ago. It's a great scene. It just contrasts how smart Rabbi Milligan is with how dumb Josto is. Josto missing? Because the sicking the police after the cannon gang was a really good play. If you just want to judge it by Machiavellian standards, he is kind of smart. What's he missing? What's he lacking? Like, is it just he's seen his old man do shit like this and he's copying and there's no like, I'm not sure exactly what he's got wrong inside him that wouldn't make him a boss, but it's something.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he just hasn't seen the monster, right? Like, Kalamita says later, like, I'm worse than the baby in the box, right? I'm a monster. Gaetano's also a monster. And Rabbi has seen the monsters, right? They were in his own family at one time. He knows who those people are, and he recognizes Gaetano for what he is, whereas maybe Josto doesn't. He's too concerned with other things. He's too concerned with, what's going on with the mayor, who we haven't seen in three episodes or whatever. He's just not taking this seriously enough, whereas Rabbi knows exactly how this goes.
Yeah, he's already got his mind on his next three moves, and he's not like, you got to fight a war right here. I thought that line about, he's assumed, well, if I put this war to bed, then, Gaetano will go back home, because what has he got here? And he's like, what has he got at home? Italy is bombed out. There's nothing. This is a boom town. Mm-hmm. Where would you want to be? The making this math problem, I thought that was a nice little running thread through the conversation where, here's the deal. This guy's going to bring in 10 or 20 guys from the old country. It's going to be seen as a gift. It's actually going to be a Trojan horse. And you got a math problem. Either divide them or they're going to multiply.
Yeah.
What a fucking speech.
It's so well written. So well written. This dialogue just pops. It's remarkable to me that some of the best scenes in Fargo can be these quiet, like just having a conversation scenes. And it kind of puts it head and shoulders above so many shows on television. Because it's not just that they're doing this math analogy, right? You got to divide or they multiply.
Right.
That's good. But then they're also mixing in like this math versus English thing and this immigrant thing. It's like, he says, plenty of people say I'm bad at English. And then Rabbi comes back with, well, they're not proud of it, right? Like he just said, hey, I've never been good at math. And he sort of says it like he's, I've never been good at math. So there's like this immigrant thing mixed up in the English. And then when he asked him if he understands what he said with this coded math language about dividing and multiplying, he asks him if he understands in Italian, right? Capisce? There's an Italian English thing going too. It's just really tightly written. I love this scene.
I love a lot of times when we talk about set pieces in television and movies, we talk in terms of big, elaborate action sequences. I love that in Fargo, they have conversational set pieces.
Yes, they do.
That are every bit as elaborately staged and set up as like the Battle of the Bastards, something like that in a Game of Thrones. And it's all just about as long, but it's all just staged over a coffee table. with extreme close-ups. It's really satisfying to watch.
And this guy playing Rabbi is fantastic.
He is amazing.
The way he's delivering these speeches, the control he's showing in these scenes is really good.
And then he goes to Satchel and tells him to be ready because when the shooting starts, we're going to vanish.
Yeah.
And I was trying to read what Satchel's expression was, and he's unreadable. Like, I think he's doing what his dad says about giving him that. Don't give him anything, It's going to be interesting to see how this develops, because like I said, I think it's the right play if you're just worried about Satchel's physical safety. But, obviously Lloyd's not going to see it that way.
Is there maybe any Satchel chance won't? That Satchel pulls a Rabbi and turns traitor on the Italians, getting Rabbi killed as well, like intentionally.
Possibly. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Man, that would just be cold. Just so cold.
Yeah. No, I think there's so many possibilities with how they've set this up and the parallels to the historical, mm-hmm. the fake historical stuff, the real historical stuff. It's, yeah, who knows where it could go. We see Gaetano arriving at a bar. He's going to have a personal meeting with Calamita away from prying eyes, and he's doing this elaborate gun dance, which is funny because I also, within the 24 hours of seeing this episode, I went back to watch Leon the Professional because it's a movie we're doing a podcast for, and it's such a homage to Gary Oldman's character, which is also and kind of... Boondock Saints a few years later played with this role with I can't remember this guy's name. Lighthouse man, Farter McGee.
Willem Dafoe. Yeah.
Old gnarly walrus dick Dafoe.
Yep.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe. His character in the investigator in the Boondock Saints had this kind of like same over the top. And here's the thing. I just have a real hard time dealing with this type of character. I believe they exist. Like, if you have this outlaw institution and every once in a while they have a fail son, they have mm-hmm. like a Joffrey, or they have a Gaetano, or they have whatever the hell Bobby Cannavale was playing in season 3 of Boardwalk Empire. Just these loose cannons. Mm-hmm. What can you do about them? They're the boss's son or whatever. They just annoy the piss out of me because it's... It's like, you know, you think of the mafia as like this institution that's like the serious thing, right? And like every once in a while you realize that it's actually literally La Familia. It's just a family.
Yeah.
And it brings them down to earth in like it defangs them in some way. It's like, well, this is their weakness, you know? They can't take care of any kind of like internal threat.
Yeah.
And but it's just so frustrating because you know as soon as this character shows up, you know how it's going to end. They're mm-hmm. not going to learn anything. They're not going to have a character arc. They're just there to persecute the smart people in the show mm-hmm. and handicap them. And it's intensely frustrating to watch. And when it's this cartoonishly played where like you can't even take him seriously, like he's not even that scary. Like, has he been pulling this shit since he's 6 years old? Like
man, I don't know. So I watched this first time through and I'm like getting it kind of wrapped up in this dance, this gun dance he's doing with the mm-hmm. operatic music playing in the back, and then he slips on this ice and I kind of chuckle, and then, you know, the kids laughing hysterically. The second time I watched this, I was that kid laughing hysterically, and it's mm-hmm. it's absolutely funnier the second time. This is high comedy to me, that they're gonna spend a minute and a half building this slip and fall scene. It's just like the fart scene in the first episode.
This season of Fargo. Yes.
They're willing to go as far as they can possibly go with these jokes. And I'm cool with that. I thought that was hilarious. But I'm with you that Gaetano is kind of a ridiculous character. And I don't know if I'm supposed to be scared of him or laughing at him. And this scene doesn't help me with that, although I will say, like, he becomes a little bit more scary in his loose cannon way when he actually is off killing people, as opposed to whatever he's been doing for the rest of the season. This scene maybe should have happened earlier. Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is, it's still, like, is it scary? Because, like, he's just, he's scary the way a pit bull, a rabid pit bull that's, like, off its rocker is scary. Like, not, yeah, like...
Yeah. Just, he's not Dr. Senator scary.
Like, no. Hey, I got a solution for this. Put it down. Mm-hmm. You know, just put it down. It's on a chain. It's over here right now. Put it down.
Well, that's the third person who's been put to a choice about their own fate or their family's fate, right? In this episode, Rabbi has told him straight up, here's what you need to do. You need to divide before mm-hmm. they multiply. Jasto's mm-hmm. not willing to do that yet. We'll see how far he has to take it before he is. But the other two were, right? Ethelreda and DeBrille both turned over their sister. He's going to have to make that choice eventually. Otherwise, it seems already too late, actually, with the death of Dr. Senator.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that... but then you got this scene where, like, I think this is kind of a nice set piece if I respected Gaetano's intellectual ability at all.
Yeah.
But like Calamita is trying to like, you know, lay this case of, hey, we got to take a real move here. We got to do this. We got to do that. And then Gaetano just fixates on this coffee, gives us this. Like I said, it's got the makings of a good speech where it's like, oh, you're Americans with your Lady Jesus and everybody wanting to be president. And, the, you know, our Jesus had to tear himself off the cross to kill all Jerusalem. Bang, bang. But it's just like, What the hell, man? This guy, if he outfights the Jostos and the cannons, and he well might, is going to be bagged by the law in like 2 weeks after because of his body count. And he's like, he doesn't even have Chris and Snoop, someone smart working for him. He's just going to be destroyed. He's going to be rolled up by fucking an outfit out of Fargo. And all he can do is destroy. Dr. Senator's summation that he's just a little boy making messes. The only thing he got wrong is he's not going to be the one that has to clean it up because his brains get blown out at the end of this episode. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I don't know. And then Calmita is like thinking like, you know, what is he thinking in this scene and the scene after he kills Dr. Senator? Like, he's got this inscrutable look on his face, but it's like, you hitched your wagon to this guy. Like, when the crazy guy came to town, you're like, hey, you know what? I want crazy. And there is a lesson to be learned there, but
I feel like this is Calamita's move. And we don't have enough, like he's making a move here. We don't have enough information about Calamita's motivations, I think. They should have they need to do more, or they should have already done more. But every scene you see him in, he's talking to Gaetano, advising him what to do, right? He's kind of the rabbi, rabbi is to Giusto, Gaetano. Yeah. But it seems more like he's trying to call the shots. He sits down with Dr. Senator. He's the one saying, hey, we need to, you know, make these moves. I don't know who's in charge here necessarily.
Hmm.
I know who thinks they're in charge. Gaetano thinks he's in charge. I'm not sure what Calamita thinks about the power structure.
If he thought he was going to be in charge, then I think this episode should have disabused him, because he is now in deep with this crazy person, which translates this transition to yet another conversational set piece in Spud's diner. Dr. Senator comes in, sees what's waiting for him. He's got this skinny Italian hitman and the greedy fat Bavarian boy from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory sitting in the corner. What, man? What? Okay. What the fuck are they trying to do with Gaetano? Now he's in the corner giggling to himself, putting just putting all the chocolate syrup into his son. Is this menacing?
It's supposed to be. I don't know that it works.
How? But yeah. Like,
I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe they're telling a story of like how gangsters can fail like in very many different ways, because I think Loy's failing a little bit. I think Gaetano's failing a lot. I think Giusto's failing a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, there's these three different ways you can run a criminal organization into the ground. What it's not is creepy. Like, Calamita is a little bit creepy with his, like, you know, no one's more dangerous than the orphan in the box.
Except for me, I'm worse than the baby in the box. Yeah,
right. That kind of worked. I did have questions like, how does he know this story?
Yeah, I mean, there's also some comedy in this scene too. It's not just Gaetano sitting over on the sidelines giving the stink eye and pouring his nuts. Mm-hmm. It's also the way that they're talking here, right? Like, that line about like, oh, you said you were done talking and yet you kept talking, that's supposed to make Calamita look kind of ridiculous. And him talking about like, oh, I'm good, you know, we're done talking, then that, and then he pulls out the knife and he's still not doing anything, right? He's brandishing all these threats, and Dr. Senator is calling him on that, but there's like a patheticness to the attempted wielding of power here that's supposed to make Calamita look a little silly.
And I think it does. And he's like, this is like speaking truth to power. Like, he's right on with, he's got this Machiavelli quote about he who wishes to obey must know how to command. You can't just show up and say, I've got the power. You got to listen to me.
Mm-hmm. Ask Theon Greyjoy.
That just works on the most insecure and weak minded.
Yeah.
Like, if you want like strong people, the kind of people that will be the backbone of your organization, you have to feel that, wielding command and power effectively is fucking art. Mm-hmm. And some people do it well, some people don't. And like,
and
you
he's
know,
trying, the, right? He's sitting in Doctor's seat. He's trying to turn trying the to tables turn the here, literally on him. But then the coffee is also a power move, right? Like when he doesn't order the coffee, when he walks in, he doesn't sit down until he's got an edge of an upper hand. And then he sits down, then he orders his coffee, and then he defiles the coffee right in front of Calamita, right? By putting this mound of sugar in it, something that Gaetano just made explicit that Italians would never do, right?
Yeah.
There's all these like intricate power dynamics at play here. And like you said, it is a beautifully orchestrated scene. It is a set piece, the likes of the Battle of the Bastards, just with dialogue and looks.
Oh, here comes the when all appears lost, here comes the coffee reinforcement.
Right.
And there's the menacing sip. Yeah.
Like, yeah, oh, now Doctor has the upper
not gonna
hand.
Come back from that. Yeah.
Nope.
It's amazing. But the thing, like I said, what I think is interesting, because all this is so well acted, like I said, Dr. Senator taking that sip of coffee is every bit as satisfying. We talked about it. It's a very similar scene in The Boys, late in season two of The Boys, where Butcher's taking that satisfying, menacing sip of tea. Uh-huh. And he says that, you know, you're making a mess that one day I'm going to have to clean up. You guys are boys, you're immature, you play at things you don't understand. He's right, but he did get something wrong, which is the Calamitas, you know, went out there and started the war. My question to you is, like, is this something that Dr. Senator calculated? Because here's my argument. Dr. Senator knew that deep down Loy is having trouble committing because of the collateral. Like, he's got his son's life in the balance. Like, everything is being... I feel like that Dr. Senator, not that he wanted to die, but he's like, I'm going to make this move that's either going to definitively put these guys on their back, or it's going to force the war so that Loy can no longer has a choice. I'm going to take this impossible choice that a father can never make. I love this kid. I'm going to take it out of his hands by kind of making myself a sacrificial lamb, because me dead in the streets, there's no way. And if Loy doesn't act right now at this precipice, our family's going to get ran off the map. I felt like it was a little bit of a sacrificial move.
So I could see reading it that way, definitely. Especially because I believe, like you said, that this is going to kick off the war officially. I don't think there's any way for Loy to ignore this.
If he does, then the FAT has just owned them. They're just a child organization at this point. There's no way you can't let this
because, like I said, this is his other family, right? It's a step too far. So it could definitely be true. The way I read it, I will say, is I think that Dr. Senator miscalculated here. I think he called their bluff, thinking that there was more of a rigid power structure over there, and that he, you know, Gaetano and Calamita didn't actually have the authorization to go do this, and because they didn't, nothing would come of it. He'd call the bluff, and that would be that for the moment.
This is the shit you're pulling when the consigliere is out of town. Like, once he comes back, once the adults are back in a room, you guys are going to get called. Okay. I can see that, too.
Yeah, or he's... Because he's taking the temperature at the beginning of this episode. He is not... You know, he's standing there trying to get a read on how serious this is and where this is coming from. And I think by the end of it, he has that read. It's just... It's wrong. Right. He read the room wrong. But either way, this is the thing that kicks off the war.
Yeah. And whether boy, the Fargo theme coming in like the hammer as the overhead shot of Doc's body is there, and it dissolves from day to night. You see the body still laying in the streets.
Yeah.
Another, you know, commentary on. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be in the morning or in the evening. Like, if he's been there literally in the fact that the cops are just not getting there, I feel like implies that this was like late afternoon rather than morning.
Oh, good point. I for some reason, I thought it was early morning before the shop opened, but right. It can't be.
I always thought, but it could, because we've seen instances where they've left black bodies out, you know, just out of disrespect. Like I said, the cops just showing up when they get there. I mean, like I said, that's a hell of a flex, but it's also Kansas City, 1950s. Sure. Either way, Loy shows up late at night, and he is just the grief he's feeling. And, like, there's this look in his face like, this resignation of like, why didn't these people believe me? Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't want to murder everyone, but now I have to murder everyone. And it yeah. might get like, he's like, I feel like all that's processing. Like, not only am I losing a father figure here, but I'm now have to commit to an action that I thought we could talk our way out of. I thought we could do this. Like, is this, and like, maybe he's even thinking like stuff his wife was saying, like, was the fucking cattle yard, was the stockyard worth it? Like what his son yeah. said, more power, more safety. You can't have both mores, you know, like these things, like it's like I said, Chris Rock, you know, is playing really, really bereft and haunted here. And I thought it worked really well.
I gotta imagine his family has to go into lockdown now, right? Like, yeah, it's gonna be extremely dangerous for both sides on the streets at the moment. So yeah, his wife, his kids are probably both all gonna have to go into lockdown.
Yeah, no, it's gonna be like in the scene from Godfather's when they go to the mattresses, and now like the yeah. Godfather's, it just felt like a home, you know, rich guy's mansion. Now it's like a fortress. There's
yeah,
chains,
six guys out front,
dudes with shotguns, yep. and yeah, it's we're now officially to the mattresses
for sure.
And if people haven't, and it's gonna be really interesting to see the different, you know, soldier versus soldier. You know, Loy's got this invisible commando unit that he's recruited. Are they gonna stay loyal because they're outlaws, but now they got a boss? How's that gonna work? So many shifting alliances, and like I said, this a lot of these characters feel very kaleidoscope, that you know, you find stuff out about them that changes how you view about them, and then that changes how they view the world, and it's just really interesting stuff. And you know, Nurse Mayflower, I thought it was really interesting to take her just off the board this episode.
Yeah, don't know where those are going to intersect. Surface.
Yeah, I wonder when she's going to surface back. We'll have to see.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, let's move on to feedback. If you'd like to send in feedback for consideration on the podcast, it's easy to do so. Fargo@baldmove.com is the address you want. And if we have time, we'll read it. Christopher says, love your show, and I think season two of Fargo is one of the most underrated TV seasons of all time. I mean, yeah, it's like people, I guess, hate on season three of Fargo, which I really liked. Everyone's got their favorites, and mm-hmm. I certainly think season two is excellent. I got my problems with the UFO stuff, but
it's the Gerhardt's one, right?
Yeah. So he links us his YouTube video and says, "I think that the ghost character from episode four looks a lot like the Undertaker character from season two of Fargo." So if you don't recall, the Undertaker was this mafia enforcer that was sent to kind of put a quash to Mike Milligan's business with the Gerhardts, and Mike Milligan and his brothers, I forget what the name of those guys are, they sliced and diced him and his associates up real good, just killed him. This does the ghost, the noseless ghost, does bear a striking resemblance to this guy's character. We're going to talk about here, man. I just want to let people know, if you didn't bother to watch the video, that's what he's talking about. The fact that Mike Milligan, a likely descendant of the Cannon family, kills this character who's clearly racist in season two. He calls Mike Milligan an eggplant at one point. In a pivotal moment right before ascending to acceptance in the Kansas City Mafia following his success against the Gerhardt family, I think is symbolic. The Kansas City mob in season two represents corporate business in America, and Milligan, unlike his ancestor Lloyd, was finally able to break into this social class and kills the ghost following his family right before. This could be a metaphor that while corporate big business is not perfect, it offered African Americans in this country more social mobility than unregulated small businesses. Watching the YouTube clip above with this theory in mind, I think explains the emphasis around the lead up to that killing and the odd fact that this Undertaker character came and went in season two, with few other characters recognizing. I also think a central theme of this show has always been there are unexplainable, unfair events in life that spawn chaos, such as the deer jumping in front of Malvo's car in season one, bringing his chaos to Bemidji, and the UFO in season two, a ghost potentially playing a pivotal role in the season's events seems in line with that theme. Yeah, I agree. I don't know what to make of, like, it's entirely possible this guy's literally the same actor. Like, they look a lot alike. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, and maybe there's a symbolic connection the way you're laying out here, but I don't think there's a literal connection, because this guy's ghost is in 1950. You know, Fargo season two takes place in the late 70s. What the shit? Like, what kind of metaphysical quantum mechanics goes into manifesting him as an assassin? You know, 30,
you're telling me
40
ghosts
years
can't
down
time
the line.
Travel. He dies
and,
in like
and
the
reincorporate,
70s and
get
back
a new
the
nose. Yeah. Sure, yeah, yeah.
No, not reincorporate. He dies as in the 70s or whatever, and then he goes back to the 50s. Like, ghosts can time travel.
The
totally.
Ghost time travel. Sure,
yeah, I can't ghost time travel.
I've seen Lovecraft Country. I know you'd speak the Book of Adam. You know, you can make things happen. Why not? Why not? Sure. I'm a believer. I'm now a subscriber to this theory.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's move on to Mark Long, who says, Satchel's name is almost certainly linked to Satchel Paige, the most famous player in Negro League history. His most famous stint in the league was spent with the Kansas City Monarchs. Story's starting to check out. When he finally got the chance to play in the major leagues, he debuted at age 42 with the Cleveland Indians and went 6-1 that year. He was inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1971. For black baseball fans, especially in Kansas City, he would be the equivalent of Babe Ruth. His most famous saying was, "Don't look back, something might be gaining on you." Interesting.
Okay.
No,
yeah,
it
makes sense. We talked a little bit about, like, what's the Monarchs thing? Why is he such a fan of the Monarchs? Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah, this is really checking out. So, like, that sells it as a nickname. Like, his father would just be calling, like, you know, "You remind me of Satchel," or whatever.
Yeah.
Just, or the way, like, you might, like, an Indianapolis Colts fan might name their son Peyton a couple years back. Like, is it that,
or middle
is this
name,
a nickname, middle name? Yeah. But yeah, I appreciate that background information. That makes a lot of sense. As the caller pointed out, or the emailer pointed out last week, they've been listening to Kansas City Monarch games during the season. So this is all starting to feel real good. Tommy from North Carolina. Deffy is Yosemite Sam after being possessed by Bugs Bunny and taking that left turn to Albuquerque.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. Sure. Sure. Hmm. See how rootin' tootin' things get by the end of the season. Eric said, probably a lock needed for that closet door in Mayflowers, eh? But I also think she might have wanted Ethelreda to snoop in there. Orretta is calculating and seems to do everything with intent. Had to know that telling Ethelreda not to look in there would make her more likely to do exactly that. What do you think of that, Jim?
Banging her head against the wall, just like waiting for Ethelreda to make her move? Is that like, is that the read here?
Yeah, so I don't want to disturb the people listening at home, but like I've listened to enough true crime and read that like if you just want to drive 6 hours away from your hometown and just murder someone at random and take them in the woods and drop them off and then never tell another soul, odds are you're going to get away with it. Now, the burning question in your mind is why the fuck would you do that? And the answer is usually your pants on head's crazy. Yeah. Because, yeah, like, why would you just murder someone for no advantage? That's where the relationship, the personal thing, that's always, you know, if you got a reason to kill someone, it's a lot easier to find that out.
Sure.
But what gets a lot of these successful serial killers is they need someone to acknowledge how smart they are. And they start playing games with the press. They start playing games with the police. And then they get caught. I think Eric here is suggesting that old Mayflower might have a little bit of this in her. That she is not satisfied with just doing her job, ushering these suffering souls to heaven. She wants credit for it. It's deep down, she wants to be discovered. Is that possible, you think?
Yeah, I suppose it's possible. I mean, she hit the jackpot here as far as evidence, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely like circumstantial, I suppose. I don't know if it's circumstantial, but like it doesn't say necessarily that she killed these people. She just has, you know, the trinkets and stuff, and she has chemicals, but she's a nurse. Would she have chemicals? I don't know. It certainly looks bad. And it would get Ethelreda thinking, but I don't know. Is her play here to like get Ethelreda to tell the doctor these things and then try and prove her wrong and torment her with like her reputation being flushed? I don't know what the end game in this is. Like maybe it's just she's crazy, you know, and she wants that acknowledgement, but
yeah. Or there's also well, I took my shot at the pie, it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
I still want revenge. So like is she looking for a reason to justify killing her, maybe? Like, well, I don't know, but it is a little sus that she's got this deep, dark secret. She invites someone into her home. She draws their attention to it. And then, yeah, doesn't have a lock on it.
She didn't really invite her into her home, though. I mean, Ethelreda, yeah. I think at one point, literally wedges her foot in the door and says, no, I want to work for you.
But she's flying at the seat of her pants, and she's even talking about how disorganized she is. They're saying something. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what it is. Moving on to Nick that says, maybe I missed it, but after an episode where Miller's Crossing and Gaetano's doppelgangers is mentioned, I have to throw in John Polito into that category. Yeah, I just watched Miller's Crossing. Thanks for the recommendation. John Polito is one of these muses for the Coen brothers, like apparently George Clooney is. He's been in five of their movies. He was a private dick in Big Lebowski.
Okay, yeah.
He does seem like he might be Gaetano's dad or uncle. He's got that same kind of roundness and well of energy and, you know, kind of like high, very, very high motor for such a big person.
Yeah.
Well spotted, I guess. And I'm glad you enjoyed Miller's Crossing. Malcolm E., do you guys think that the names are an indication of who will win this year? Cannon Fada? Are they both cannon fodder for a third entity? Listener since Blue Yonder, by the way. Wow. That's incredible. I can't believe we've retained a person through all that we've been. That's amazing. So thank you. Am I the biggest idiot in the world? I didn't make the Cannon Fada connection.
Really?
Until Malcolm emailed in. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I made it a couple episodes ago. I don't think we talked about it though. Yeah. I mean, look, they're both crime organizations, right? The cops could be the third party here that win the day. Mm-hmm. Deffy could also see them just destroying each other and then having like a rabbi and Satchel get away, like we think is going to happen with some kind of Mike Milligan transformation. There's a lot of ways this could go, but I don't see it going well for either side of this.
Mort Kellerman could be that third party, mowing them down.
Absolutely.
With the 200 guns he's just gotten. So yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I think that, yeah, that is significant. The fact that Mike or the Rabbi Milligan just said that they're all going to die. You know, I think there's going to be a similar body count over on the Italian side.
Mm-hmm.
Cannon fodder does seem like it's a pretty apt name for these people.
Yeah.
Kaylee says, long-term listener to your, or long-time listener to your podcast, and is definitely one of my favorites. Well, thank you, Kaylee. Short and sweet. I listened to another podcast, Fargo Talks Fargo, I think. My God, podcast infidelity, Jim. Let's should we countenance it? I suppose.
Yeah, we're going to have to put you to a choice. We're either going to get you expelled or you're going to start listening exclusively to the Fargo podcast.
Anyway, Fargo Talks Fargo, we're speaking about the symbolism of the Gemini, which Lady Dr. Death has already mentioned astrology. She's, what is she, a Sagittarius? Is that what she is?
That sounds right.
I don't truck with the star signs myself, but she has invoked astrology for sure.
Mm.
As a Gemini myself, I found this connection very interesting. The colors for Gemini are red and green. Everywhere in the show, there's dual colors of red and green. There's a guy's name in the Fada family is Gemini. I don't know that I know who Gemini Fada is, but apparently he's dressed in mostly red. Is there something there or not? I mean, Noah Hawley is big into colors and symbolism and thematically tying characters to things, right? Yeah. Like Cannon Fodder, you know?
Absolutely.
He definitely leans into that stuff. So, like, to the fact that I did some research into what Gemini, like, mean star signs, and, like, there's a lot of different stuff, but the thing that kept on coming up the most was dual nature. So I wonder, I guess I need to find out who this character is, start paying attention to them. I guess that's what I'm saying is, like, we need to maybe be on the lookout for that because, you know, some kind of spy, some kind of double agent could certainly turn the tide in the war. So if he's being coded as such, perhaps we should pay more attention to it. So,
I've got an alternate theory here on what's going
on. Yeah.
Because I noticed Josto this episode wearing a red coat, like a subdued red coat, but some violently red socks in that rabbi scene. Mm-hmm. I also noticed the wreath behind them on the wall. I noticed that it's December. I noticed that it's Christmas time. This could just be stylistically, you know, they want to evoke Christmas in everything they're doing, hence the red and green.
You're playing the Saint Nick card, eh?
Yeah, yeah, you got to. It's December.
That's true. He does have a point. So we can blame Christmas, but let's keep an eye on this Gemini guy.
For sure.
And see if things shake out going forward. Dave McBee, I love that the show is back, and I've gone back and rewatched season one, and I'm now in season two. You mentioned a number of times that a UFO was too outrageous of a deus ex machina. Of course, it was one, but they did lay the groundwork for the UFOs in the very first scene of season one and spread sprinkles throughout the season. It's not enough to warrant the involvement of a UFO in a shootout, but looking back, it isn't out as left field as you may remember. Anyway, keep up the good work, guys. Even though we get episodes late here in Australia, I can't wait for it to drop each week. Well, I appreciate that. And as far as the UFO, it's like, I did record 20-some hours of my thoughts on season two when it was happening. And, like, I don't want to gainsay old Aaron. Because, I had my emotional reaction. And you're not wrong. It wasn't like it came out of left field. It's more of like, you know, did it justify the warrant of the involvement? And, like, honestly, we are outliers in this opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to convince people to feel a way about a thing. I'm just telling you how I felt about it. Because, honestly, season two, most people like way better in season three, as far as IMDb ratings, as far as like the general feeling, as far as I can tell from like the Reddit community. I just, you know, I'm an outlier. I like season three better. So I think season three might be my favorite, even better than one, which I loved.
Yeah, I mean, Vargas is so good.
I've never seen a bad guy like that. And it had like it, and it did have its metaphysical stuff too, but And it was kind of more out, you know, out there and out of left field, but I felt like it wasn't as pivotal. I don't know. Maybe I'm just a giant hypocrite when it comes to
I don't know. It's been opinions. So long, right? It's been 3 years since I've even seen that season, let alone seasons two and season one. I don't know which is my favorite.
For my defense, I will just suggest playing the entirety of the penultimate episode of season two Fargo podcast.
Okay.
I guess that's all I can do, I guess.
Yeah.
Mark writes in and says, hey guys, I got to thinking about how it is that Dr. Senator and the Consigliere of the Fada family always end up at that diner whenever they need to talk. Does Dr. Senator eat there every morning? Does he just happen to have open office hours where the Consigliere's can just come and talk things out when needed? Or they both end up just going there whenever there is some event that seems to need their attention? In modern times, this is easily remedied with cell phones, but I just don't understand how they end up there together so often. Love the show, among with so many others. Department of Homeland Security, Better Cast Saul, Watchmen, just to name a few. Appreciate all that loyalty. Mm-hmm. And glad to have you along with Fargo, too. What's your take on this? What's going on at Spud's Diner?
So I feel like Spud's is the home base of Dr. Senator. He spends a lot of time there. He can be found most often at Spud's, and everybody knows it. And I don't think it's a secret. You've got guys, like if you look at the way that the meetings with the Consigliere went down and versus this one, right? Dr. Senator goes to this place after hours. I think after hours, although...
Yeah, that's the thing. Coffee, we don't know, but...
I don't know.
Yeah, hey, coffee. People drink coffee all hours of the day.
It's true, usually. But she's asking him, like, oh, do you want a cup of coffee? I feel like that's his usual. You know, he'd be coming in around this time, sitting down. The last time the guys were there, right? He had his whole crew there, kind of watching the windows and watching the doors. This time he's there alone. I don't know if he got called in. It's tough to say. I don't know that we have enough info.
And I feel like this is one of the canon's fronts. Like, they own this place in the same way that, like, they owned the funeral parlor or, like, the Italians own Joplin's sundry store.
Yeah.
And the way canon owns whatever that backroom numbers deal is. Like, that's this, like, yeah, you're right. This is Dr. Senator's kind of, you know, this is like Stringer Bell hanging out at the mortuary in season 2 and 3 of The Wire. Like, this is just his base of operations. But yeah. I think all those other explanations you give are satisfying, too. Like, maybe now that they got exchange sons, it's not a bad idea for the consigliaries to meet, get a working relationship, you know, establish that back channel of communication in times of peace. Maybe, I mean, they don't have cell phones, but they do have fucking POTS lines, plain old telephone lines, you know, just, hey, we got some shit to talk about. The dirty birds are flying, meet at Spud's. And then they just meet there the next day or, you know, whenever. Like, yeah, I don't think it's mysterious, but I like your idea that this is just Doc's office, man.
It feels like that's right, but I don't
know. He's not at home, and if he's not meeting with Loy, he's just down at Spud's keeping an eye on things.
Yeah.
Making sure the town's running right, seeing the people coming in needing help or whatever. That's what he's there for. Gary from Minneapolis has a final email. Says, something has not been rubbing me the right way with Chris Rock's character Loy. I've seen a similar sentiment on the Fargo subreddit and heard it in your podcast, but it's always nebulous. I think one of you said that they aren't buying the character. At first, I thought it was just difficult for Chris Rock to take his distinctive voice seriously in a dramatic role. Every time he revs up and starts yelling, it's the same voice that delivered the tossed salad man bit to me, and it kind of breaks immersion. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I definitely hear that, too. A few episodes in and the feeling has passed, but I think what's bothering me most is that Loy is not consistent within the Fargo universe. Fargo's built on flamboyant and extremely flawed characters. Those that are level-headed and competent are surrounded by cartoon characters holding them down. Ma Gerhart is a great example of this, as are the previous cop protagonists. Loy is super competent, expressing keen insight and analysis in the situations. He knows that the stick-up isn't the Italians. He has the idea for credit cards and their effect on consumer spending. His rapid deconstruction of the OCD cop seems like it should have brought in some consequences from the racist 50s cops, but it didn't. I don't think the character has been wrong about anything thus far. The closest thing to a cartoon character on this side is the henchman that looks like Lamont from Sanford and Sons, Leon, I think is who he's talking about. But the balance still seems quite off. I wouldn't call Loy a Mary Sue, as this episode shows he can be brutal, threatening to paint a couple's kitchen with their blood and threatening their daughter. I also wouldn't say he fits the magical Negro trope, since he's definitely his own character and isn't steeped in some kind of shitty stereotypes. I just find he's simply too competent and held back only by society's racism. He even faces down an angry black mama, even her mama, a very powerful trope in her media. It just doesn't make for a very compelling character in the universe. Am I off base here, or does he have shortcomings that I haven't seen? Further, and maybe this is suited for more the three right turns conversation, but does the use of super competent characters from disadvantaged groups help or harm in the greater social context? The closest trope I can think of here is the tough chick trope from action movies. I understand the instinct is to use these characters as an answer to historical stereotypes, but on the other hand, it takes flaws to make a believable human character. One goes so far as to say that Loy's analytical superpowers are dehumanizing, but it seems to stand in the way of putting people of disadvantaged groups on the same plane as everyone else. Does the Cannon Gang need more goofballs to fit into the Fargo universe? I think is maybe the question Gary's asking, and also is there some racism, or what's going on here? What do you got to read on it, Jim?
I mean, if Leon's the goofiest guy you have to offer up as a crew, yeah, you probably could use a little more goofiness on that side. I think, I don't know, as far as like the, you know, the questions about the tough, you know, Terminator style female protagonist, I think like heroes are good to have, and I don't know that they always need to be flawed. Like, I having a good example, they don't always need to be super realistic, and I think, like, look, there's nothing realistic about some of these characters in Fargo, right? A lot of them are nuanced, a lot of them are flawed and intricately written, but not all of them, and I think that's fine. I don't know that it's a problem.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of ways you can look at this. I can't remember what podcast. It might have been Dan Harmon's Whiting Wong's podcast, but there's someone on there talking about like the different phases that minority groups have when they are integrated into like popular culture. Like, you've got, and I'm paraphrasing here, but you got like the appropriative phase where it's like, you know, we like the way black people sing and dance, but we're not comfortable having black folks around the white people. So let's hire a white man that can sing and dance like a black man and just paint him up black. And there you go. Then you have like stereotypical, where it's like, you know what? Let's cut out the middleman. We're comfortable having the black men sing and dance for us now. Mm-hmm. Then you have tokenized, where it's like, this stereotypes, like the more we get to know black people, they don't fit in these narrow categories. And we're trying to be kind of like woke and progressive. So let's just, instead of having a white person, let's take that character and just make him black. Nothing else about them. It's just, they're just the same, like they're a white character except for the black. Okay. They're tokens.
Yeah.
Then you have authentic depictions where you actually get to know these people, like, you know, warts and all, like their struggles, and they explain the situations. And then you get the accepted phase where it's like, you don't have to make the character have this entire long backstory. You can just, like, the same way, like, when you see a person putting on dog tags in a movie, you don't have to explain what it is, what a soldier is, and like what they might view patriotism and sacrifice. Just like all these ideas are just baked in because we've seen 100 movies about what it means to be a soldier, good and bad, in between, the struggles, the PTS. Like, you can start to do that once black characters get to this level. You don't have to have a whole fucking movie about why they are the way they are. It's like they can just have a single thing where they put on a ring and that ring means something, or, you know, like, and I think that like Fargo's in an area where There's two things. There's some of that where it's like we're still not at the fully accepted thing. So like a black gangster in 1950s, well, you're saying something, right? You're not just telling a story. There's politics involved, right? And then second is, you know, like in something really silly like Anchorman, right? You've got this thing where it's boys versus girls. And like, if they were ever to make an Anchorman 3, and the concept was the Veronica Silverstone, or whatever her name was, Corningham, she's going to get an all-female cast of anchors in the early 80s or late 70s. they would probably not be buffoonish characters, right? Because they're contrasting like how sharp these women have to be to defeat these mediocre buffoons, right? I think there's a little bit going on there with this, that like, if you had a bunch of buffoons in Cannon's group, you wouldn't buy them as successful gangsters, because the Italians and the Irishmen and these gangs can have a couple of idiots. They can survive that. They can be that sloppy. They can be that sentimental. A black gangster can't. I think that's a little bit what they're saying too. Is like if half of Cannon's gang was a bunch of doofuses, you'd be like, well, how the hell are they even competing in this town?
Yeah,
with all the other disadvantages. So I think they're both like a mix of that is like explaining why he is. Because you're right. Normal Fargo gang would have a lot more people to laugh at, and like, you know, you would have like Nick Cannon's bust dancing to opera and busting his ass on a frozen sidewalk, right?
Right.
He'd have a cousin that's talking like Nacho Libre, or I don't know.
I do wonder.
Hootie Tang.
Pretty often when like movie myth becomes too accepted, it's like, and it starts to distort what people think about actual history, right? Like,
yeah,
if you want to actually, let's say you're writing a movie and you want to actually get to the heart of some time period that we no longer live in, or some group of people that you don't have firsthand experience with, you can either go get that firsthand experience. If it's the group of people with the time period, it's tough. You have to do a ton of research.
Sure.
Or you can lean on the movie myth that's been created, right? And that can feed back in to itself and create some distorted view that the population at large has about a time period or a group of people. It seems really difficult to get out of that trap. And I think like movie myth creation is culturally fascinating, and maybe detrimental. I don't know. I don't know where to weigh that out.
It is weird. No, because like you got Errol Flynn's Robin Hood, where like they're all wearing green tights, you know, and then like you've got
Kevin Costner.
You got Kevin Costner's, and they're like, okay, well, let's take Errol Flynn, but let's make it look cooler. You know, it's the same essential character. And then you got Russell Crowe coming around. It's like, well, actually, if these people were real characters and they're living in like the 10th century AD, they'd look a lot more like Rome, you know, and like that now it's like not doesn't look or even act like Errol Flynn at all. And now that's informing the next view that you'll have of Robin Hood.
Exactly. Yeah. And the next writer who will have that view because of the movies they saw and incorporate that into the next generation's views. It's this weird perpetuating thing.
And because it's also like it's impossible to not see the parallels between this season of Fargo and like American Gangster. This thing is insanely informed by Denzel Washington's head of that family.
Sure.
And I think that like you're exactly right. You've got that's like where things become so accepted that you use them as shorthand for so long that then it becomes it takes on this entirely other meaning.
Yeah.
Like Soldier is a good example. Like, you know. An audience watching Soldiers today would feel very differently about an audience in the 50s watching Soldiers, which is differently entirely how we felt in the 70s and 80s watching things about Soldiers. So it's like you've got all this stuff that goes into a stew, and as you said, the myth making. So but I think all of that is I think coming together and striking your as like, well, it either as feels unrealistic or it doesn't fit quite into the Fargo universe. But I, you know, the other thing is like the Fargo universe has always been flexible enough to take on the full gamut of Coen Brothers films, and Coen Brothers films are also have that like purely serious criminal, you know.
They do, yeah.
It's like, you know, if you go back to like the duel between Anton Sugar and Josh Brolin and No Country for Old Men, like those are very smart. They're not making mistakes. They're just skillfully going about their things until one of them, you know, commits an unforced error or whatever, or a forced error. It's not all like wall-to-wall buffoons, right?
No, that's the thing that always amazed me about the Coen catalog is the breadth of it. It's just like, Yeah, they'll do ridiculous, silly things, but they'll also do extremely tightly plotted murder mysteries and thrillers and surrealist stuff. And it's just, they have written so many different kinds of films that it's hard to pin them down and say this is what Coen's is, which I think that's a advantage that Fargo has, you know, not just taking from the Fargo film, it's taking from all of it, and it allows them to tell really any kind of story they want to tell.
Yeah, with the help of having this cultural shorthand to fully explain it. Yeah, I think it's great too. It's a really flexible universe.
And I do agree that Fargo itself, the TV show, has developed a style. You know, there are things that are definitively Fargo, the TV show now. And that's probably where you're feeling that dissonance there.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Imagine trying to judge the Coen films from the first three ones they made, you know? Like, you only got three.
Blood Simple is so radically different from The Big Lebowski, right?
Right. I don't know the exact three, but, like, Blood Simple, The Big Lebowski, or like Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, and Hudsucker Proxy.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot of different tone and skill level and filmmaking and cinematography. So, yeah, I appreciate the email, Gary, and it led to an interesting discussion. So that's all we have for the Fargo mailbag this week. If you'd like to send in some for consideration, again, fargo@baldmove.com, or there's always a forums.baldmove.com if you want to get in the Fargo thread and start participating there. Otherwise, man, I think we got a hot gang war in cold Kansas City going down here, Jim, and what are they going to, it's going to be explosive what happens next week, I'm sure. Or I don't know, like, you just had the death of a major character, maybe they need to take a couple breaths. You got to respond.
Yeah, you can't let this slide.
It's like, man, are there going to be any more set building piece episodes throughout the whole rest of the season? This thing could just be a downhill run from here on out, but we'll have to see. We'll be back next week to discuss it regardless. And until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you next week.